Hello and welcome to another edition of the Albion Roar in association with the old Shelley Brothers, oldfootballshirts.com. Here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, smart speaker and podcast. My name's Alan Wares. In a week when the VAR controversy has once again arbitrarily dumped its load like a Brighton seafront flock of seagulls aiming for the world's biggest bag of chips, the football world, or at least the English part of it, is united in wondering whether PG Moll has finally gone a step too far. Are we at home to a conspiracy or cock-up? A deliberate plan by England's football authorities to halt Brighton's seemingly avaricious advance for glory? Or is it all part of another deliberate plan to lobotomise England's referees into gibbering simpletons? To discuss this and many more of Kane and Son's hold over English football elite, we welcome back Vic and Vic, namely our good friend Vicky Reese and John Palfrey, known to many as Vicar. Welcome to the Raw, or welcome back, first and foremost, notwithstanding Saturday's nonsense. How are you?
Pretty good. Yeah, pretty good. Week off work. So can't complain.
Mood returning slowly.
John, it's. I mean, obviously we've had Vicky on a few times, but it's been a while since you've been on. So can you just remind our listener of your Albion supporting background?
Yeah, he goes. Late '60s, started going to the Goldstone Ground, and really haven't looked back since. I think the opportunity came for me to go to university in the late '70s, and I kind of flipped out on that because I didn't really want to leave Brighton at a time when the Albion were, you know, trailblazing at their time. So basically probably chucked in a reasonably decent career to go and work in a bank so that I could carry on watching and funding watching the Albion.
Where was your offer of education?
Pretty damn stupid. Norwich UEA.
Yeah.
Computer studies. I could have made a fortune. Wow. He went to work in a bank instead. How stupid.
Yes, but look at your career path since. You've gone everywhere in the world, and surely within every traveller there's a book, isn't there?
Yeah, yes. Well, we're still talking about that one. So basically, yeah, I mean, I left the bank after 16 years, flipped out, went around Mexico, came back, got myself a job in the travel business, and really didn't look back. And had a really great career with our blue box friends over at American Express.
Fair enough.
I say that actually, you know, with a degree of pride. They're a great company to work for.
Fair enough. So you say late 60s.
Hell, it's my chicken in the post.
Can you remember your first game? You remember your actual first game, John?
Sorry?
Can you remember your actual first Albion game?
I certainly can, yeah. It was against Walsall, 67. I didn't want to go. My dad insisted that I went. I really wasn't interested. 90 minutes later, I was a screaming nervous wreck. It was just like all the colour, all the enthusiasm. It was just something like I'd never seen before.
Was it a daytime game or an evening game?
Yeah, it was an evening game. We lost 3-2, of course. And I think we were 3-1 down, 3-0 down, pulled it back to 3-2. I was shouting, screaming like a mad thing.
Fantastic. Vicky, was yours a similar story where your dad dragged you with or against your will?
I don't think he dragged me. I think my brother's a year younger than me, and he used to, despite that, you know, on the Saturday, my mum used to go shopping in Brighton and my dad would drop her off there with us. And then there was a point when he started trying to take my brother along, and he was never that bothered. And then my mum said to my dad one day, why don't you take Vicky? And he did. And that was it. For me, first game, bang, that was it. I wanted to go every week.
So it was a case of you going to the game, weren't so sure, 90 minutes later, to coin a phrase, a gibbering wreck.
Well, I mean, I was about 10, and I don't really remember having any feelings about football one way or the other prior to that, you know, but I just loved it. And I suppose for me, it's a bit of me and spending a bit of time with my dad as well without my brother being around. It's quite, on a selfish level, that's quite nice as well. But I just knew straight away that I just absolutely loved the football. And I was like, right, buy me the kit, buy me everything, you know, keep taking me to games, which, you know, £1.50 to get in or something was probably an easy thing to do.
I think it was 20p. My dad gave me 20p to get into the kiddies entrance when my first game in 1970. John, you we didn't even have new pence when you first went.
I certainly didn't. No, I mean, you know, as you say, it was pay on the gate. If you felt that way inclined, you could just shimmy underneath the turnstile.
Right, enough doughy-eyed, misty-eyed history. We've got to
Ooh.
attack the herd of elephants in the
Yes,
basement here.
we have.
Okay, so we went to Tottenham. We were in good form. You could argue it was a 6 points, or at least everyone seems to be thinking that here we are challenging for a Champions League spot, which is another argument entirely, but certainly a European spot. A victory would have put us within a point of Spurs with a couple of games in hand. The lineup was basically there was only two changes, so it was a very familiar and very well constructed Albion setup who we knew that were going to boss the ball. But John, I don't know if you could tell from your vantage point, there was a lot of finger pointing even before a ball was kicked, wasn't there, on the touchline?
I mean, Roberto was in his usual fine form before the match. I understand that there's a little bit of history between himself and the Tottenham boss, who has a very interesting past history, which we'll go into, I'm sure.
I'm sure without
And
maybe checking with the lawyers.
yes, and had also been rather rude about Roberto in the press, I believe, in the days coming up to it, and the Italians alike on things like face and credibility.
Yes.
Red rag to a bull. He got him set up and asked for it. And Roberto wasn't going to sit back, was he?
Vicky, it was all a bit unnecessarily from Stellini during the week, wasn't it?
To be honest, I missed most of that until the game started, and then you started to see stuff on social media about De Zerbi pointing fingers at him. But I was aware of the let's just call it the ban that Stellini has previously had for
Yes.
his involvement with Juventus. Spurs aren't doing very well with that, are they? Because their director of football has just been banned as well. Also to do with Juventus, I think, in the past. So they've now got to go and find another DOF at Spurs. So they're going well. And I think, I mean, I knew nothing of, as I said, at the game, didn't know anything about what had gone on with De Zerbi at that point. But it was just sort of going around on social media. And then obviously it all kicked off later in the game.
Notwithstanding that we know that De Zerbi is a fiery character, and when he arrived, he promised fireworks on the touchline. Given that he's the head coach of your football club, and obviously chairman and coaches and players come and go, and the fans are the constant here. So I think it's not unreasonable for us to say it's our club or it's your club or it's like whatever it might be. How do you feel about Roberto Di Zerbi representing you and your club and his behaviour on the touchline?
I think for me, there's very little that I've seen that's actually. If I mean, obviously there have been occasions when he's. Well, I think one of the occasions where he was banned previously or sent off, he's supposed to have said something to the ref. If you take it at face value, what he said to the referee, it doesn't actually sound that bad. So I don't see him jumping up and down, getting in the face of the fourth official or at the referee or gesticulating. I don't see that at all. I'm not even sure what went on Saturday, so perhaps it's not fair to judge that one. But you know what? I've seen far worse this season from Lopetegui, he's the Wolves manager these days, isn't he? From him, Thomas Frank gets involved with officials all the time. He's always sticking his nose in. He's quite large nose. And you just, I'm not sure that there's been that much worse from De Zerbi than from anyone else. I mean, it is lovely to have someone that looks like he cares. That's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, I don't want him to keep getting banned, but it's quite nice to have someone that actually gets
The
that
word is
passion out.
passion.
Go
It's
on,
as simple
John.
as that. The word is passion. It's as simple as that.
But does passion have to actually always sort of show itself? Can passion be from within? Can it show itself in a different manner? Does it irk you at all that, here we have this kind of this lunatic on the side here representing your club? Who has to spend more time in the stands than he does on the touchline. Is that something that actually you care about? I mean, obviously, given that whether it affects the players or not is another matter. But as someone who's representing your club, is it something that irks, bothers you at all, or is it something that just washes off you?
Providing he's still in the stadium, I'm happy. He gets a better view of the game. We have telecommunications these days, they're second to none. So all I can see is him sitting further up in the stand with a better view of the game.
And I think, you know, he, as I said, I'm not sure is he, if he, A, is he really that bad? And B, is the problem now that because he's had a couple of red cards, well, he's now got the third one, are the touchline officials and the referees now zooming straight away onto him for anything? Whereas perhaps with someone perceived to be more laid back, they wouldn't be remotely interested. Are they now zoning in? Are they sitting there before the game going, do you know what? You need to keep an eye on De Zerbi. I mean, the biggest joke, well, there was lots of big jokes about the weekend, but there was an article on Sunday, I think it was by Matt Law in the Telegraph, that said, has Roberto De Zerbi ruined his chances of being Spurs manager with his outbreak? Because Spurs wouldn't possibly want someone with that kind of attitude at their club. You know, they're all right with people that have been banned for all sorts of other things, but no, we can't have someone that gets a bit excited on the touchline. They've just had Antonio Conte, for goodness sake. They can't possibly rule out De Zerbi for that reason. As if he was even interested. The presumptuousness of that article really ground my gears, but there we go.
Yeah, how arrogant was that?
Yeah.
I love the scarf salesman outside the ground selling two Conte scarves for a fiver.
It's the weird thing is that the Matt Law writes specifically for the Telegraph, maybe on the subject of Tottenham Hotspur. I mean, I don't think there is a particular correspondent for Brighton in any of the national dailies or even the Sundays or anything like that. Obviously, we've got Andy Naylor at The Athletic.
Yeah.
But if he's actually writing what effectively is a puff piece for Tottenham Hotspur, saying, you know, it doesn't even stop to think about De Zerbi's, you know, coaching tactics. But then look at De Zerbi's predecessor, who is probably English football's greatest cautionary tale for going to a big club ahead of time. So, what do you think Matt Law was thinking of in thinking that De Zerbi would A, want to go to Spurs and B, anytime soon?
Well, you see, here's the thing. As De Zerbi continues these character traits, which what other major league club, top six club, is going to be looking at taking him on or trying to poach him? So it works in our favour, I think, that you know he's the wild child. Do we want him at our club? We certainly want him here.
Yes.
And let's face it, with the way that Tottenham play currently, no matter what Matt Law says, Tottenham would bite their own arms off to have to play the sort of football that De Zerbi has got Albion playing. They are turgid. They're a turgid team to watch Tottenham. They have been in both games we've seen this season and in all their other games, pretty much, haven't they? They have absolutely stunk the Premier League out the entire season, and somehow they're still top five. It's astonishing.
Yeah, how
Yeah,
does
I
that
think.
happen? I don't understand.
Well, they do have, and this is where we're going to. I think we've finally, I'll say, finally got to deal with what's going on here. So, before we talk about specifically the instances within the game, you do have to look at the fact that certainly Harry Kane, not literally, because you know maybe he has murdered someone, who knows? But that fella gets away with murder, and we could actually make a long case for the things that he has got away with. And he was doing it again on Saturday with quite a bit of aplomb. I mean, is it actually part of the same narrative that Harry Kane can do what he does, you know, week in, week out? It's the same narrative as the referee's behaviour in our game.
Well, it does make you wonder if there's external influences. Again, because we're on the radio, I can do that.
Yes. I think our lawyer might say no, but you know, Vicky, you must have obviously you've commented many times on Harry Kane's behaviour. Is it something to do with the Premier League? Is it something to do with the FA? Is it something to do with the fact it's a big six club? I mean, when you see the referee's behaviour this weekend, do things actually start making themselves clearer, or are you feel worried that you're going to be sort of looking at conspiracy theories here?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, you need to be very careful with the whole kind of conspiracy theory. You know, you can take this too far, can't you? Much as I think that, you know, there have been numerous studies done, for example, as to the effect of a crowd on officials, which is why statistically more decisions do go in favour of home teams. And that happens at any level. You know, when you've got the crowd the majority of the crowd screaming for something to happen, it almost can't help but influence the referee. And that, for me, that's happening on an unconscious level. I'm not sitting there for 1 second. If you look at a team, say, especially a team in, you know, if you've got a big club in someone like League One, say Sheffield Wednesday, when you've got a, you know, a relatively large crowd for the division, you've got, you know, 16,000 Wednesday fans shouting and screaming when they're playing Accrington or someone, you know, that's a penalty. If you're the actual referee in the game, and this is where the VAR argument falls down slightly, but if you are the official in that game and you have 16,000 people suddenly screaming for something, or 60,000 people, whatever, you must, even if you didn't see something straight away, you must have something in the back of your head going, did I miss something there? You know, has something happened? And, you know, it's not, I don't even think that's on a conscious level. There's almost an unconscious bias there. Do I think referees are conspiring against clubs like us? I can't honestly believe that's happening. I can't honestly believe that, you know, we talk about big six bias. Again, maybe it's an unconscious thing. I don't genuinely think that there is any, you know, there's any, it's not a situation that, you know, you have seen it thrown around this week. Is there money changing hands and all that? I don't believe that for a second, but it's probably a lot easier for a referee to sort of fall over and give something when you've got England's leading goal scorer in your ear, because that's what Harry Kane does all game, every game. He basically referees matches. You know, he is constantly in the referee's ear. There was even a moment on Saturday when he actually got taken out by one of his own teammates, and he's still on at the ref, putting his hands up, going, "Why haven't I got a free kick, ref?" And it was one of his own players that had fallen into him. And I don't know. I think. Clearly, it doesn't really explain the VAR, because they're in an office and they are watching the footage without the sound on. And I still cannot fathom how you can get to the conclusion that the VAR did at the weekend with several of those decisions. You know, you could pick anyone, at least four, probably five.
We'll come to those one by one in a second. But
and he's taking the fall, isn't he, now, the VAR guy? Salisbury, is it? Back at
Michael Salisbury, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he is and he isn't, and I'll come to why he isn't in a second. Mm-hmm. But let's go through this one by one. I want there's five, the main five I want to pick out here, irrespective of the goals. So the first one I want to pick out is the Højbjerg penalty. Obviously, the main thing I really want to start with is the big positive from the game, is that the Albion, largely from minute one to minute 90, were brilliant. They bossed the game, they had the possession, they had the chances, all the stats go with them. So let's take at least that from that. Before we start feeling sorry for ourselves later down the line, oh, woe is us, you know, we're not getting the breaks, we're not getting the referees. We were still brilliant, and we're still going to have a fighting chance, all the while we still do play as well as we did against Spurs. So let's look at the Højbjerg one. Now, from where you were, did anything really ring true? Irrespective of what you saw on Match of the Day later.
Spot on penalty, I was right in line with it.
Vix?
Yeah, I thought, it was one of those ones, at first sight, I thought, oh, I think he's been caught there, but you're never quite sure, are you?
And sorry, I'm talking about the Højbjerg handball here, where he actually kind of sticks his arm out.
Oh, sorry.
Longley.
I didn't see it from where I was.
Oh, didn't see that one in the first half, because that was up the other end of the pitch. So all the Albion players have appealed for that one, but we didn't see, yeah, that's too far up the pitch for us to see, I think.
And now you've seen it on Match of the Day, or seen it on, you know, sort of a, pick a platform. Is that one where you think, actually, in all my rage, in all my incandescence, I'll give you that one, because it's...
I think, yeah. Again, they didn't show it on Match of the Day because they had too many other awful decisions to go through. But Shearer referenced it, didn't he, on Match of the Day? He actually said there was a handball by Longley as well, and we haven't even got time to show that. I think, having seen the replay about an hour ago, which is the first I've seen of it, he looks like he swipes it away from one of our players, whether, you know, it's a light touch, whether he meant to, I don't know. I don't think it's the most obvious. He does touch it with his hand, so yes, should be a penalty. Of course it should.
Yes, but like you say, you reckon you two are at the other end of the pitch, John?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, we didn't see it, we only saw it in the replays and the rather cunningly put together highlights by the Arsenal fans at the end of it.
Okay, well, let's go to the first goal then. Notwithstanding what we think is possibly a little bit of lapsed defending, that was a beauty, wasn't it?
Yes, Peach.
Song's gone.
Yeah, I mean, we're only 10 minutes in. you can clearly still see it's against the run of play, which is totally irrelevant, but it's against the run of play. And, you know, if it's one of your own, you're thinking, you know, there's goal of the season until it gets chalked off. But it's annoying, isn't it? Because their record against us, Kane and Son, is ludicrous.
Yep. Yeah.
It was shades of knockout against Palace, that goal, wasn't it? Step aside and loop it over. Ideal world, you get your defender tighter on him. Don't give him the shot. Don't give him the shot. He's been awful all season. Oh, there we go. That's the frustration. He has been rubbish this season, Son.
Yeah. So, okay, again, 7 minutes later, the Albion still bossing the game. And we're getting the, I think, is it McAllister plays a lovely little chip through ball to Mitoma, who, despite being a winger, is actually sometimes playing like a centre forward. Now, I actually learned something new about this later, about where handball starts and stops. But in the great scheme of the game itself, again, I guess probably because it was at the far end, did you have any inkling as to why it was being disputed?
Not initially. Not because it didn't come up on the board straight away, did it, John? I think,
no.
You know, it was, I mean, we certainly didn't see any flag from the linesman, so I'm assuming he did flag at some stage.
Because the play stopped and that, you know, we knew within a few seconds to stop celebrating because, you know, the referee was looking at the line.
Very minimalistic.
We knew that it had been called. We weren't waiting for VAR.
But again, because it's at the far end, we're like, is it offside? Is it something else? And you know, it wasn't like one of these ones where you thought, oh, that could be handball. You know, you didn't really pick up on that straight away. Maybe it's offside or something. So that's what we were kind of waiting for, some kind of marginal offside, perhaps. Mm. But, you know, draw the lines where you like. But then it came back, didn't it? So.
Okay, so now you've seen it on the TV. this is where we have to sort of like talk about the technicalities. And this is the difference between this and the other disallowed goal is that the technicality is that the on-pitch decision was no goal because the linesman flagged, and obviously the referee's going to go with him because he says handball. Okay, so VAR's got to look at it. Was it handball? Was it not handball? So the on-pitch decision, and I'm lapsing into that, I'm paraphrasing here, that you actually go with umpire's call.
Yeah.
I assume that actually, and let's try and be objective and not look through my... Was there anything that said, and if you can... I don't know, quantify clear and obvious that there is something out there that says, right, this must be 95% or 100% or whatever it must be, a clear and obvious error. Could you actually say that was not even a probable error, but a clear and obvious error by the linesman, either of you?
Because the linesman is pointing here.
Don't forget, John, we're on radio.
Okay, sorry. The linesman is pointing to his... basically just below the shoulder blade.
Yes.
And that's legal. So the very point that the ball hit just below the shoulder blade,
yeah,
is not an offence.
Yes.
Why is he calling it?
Yes. I think it's kind of a surprise that he then flags, because generally speaking, a lot of the time now you tend to get them not flagging because they know that VAR will have a look and VAR will then pull it out if it deserves to be pulled out. So, you know, in his mind, I guess he must have been very sure that hit Matoma's arm. I think subsequently he's been proved to be wrong, but clearly in the eyes of the interpretation of the laws, they've decided that's not clear and obvious enough.
Have you ever seen a linesman give a contentious handball to the extent that because they have to know, don't they?
I think I'm sure you have. I'm sure that at the end of the day, that there's going to be a little bit of confirmation bias going on here from us, isn't it? Because we will only remember the ones that adversely affect us. All these, anything that's happened in the past that's gone in our favour, we just merrily skip over it, carry on, and you know, you don't think about it, do you? So I don't know is the answer to that. It must have happened at some point. Of course, linesmen flagged for handball because linesmen flagged for penalties sometimes, don't they? You know, they put the flag up and give the ref the signal. So. Must do it. The big thing for me is I'm going to be skipping forward slightly here, but the contrast in clear and obvious error application between that disallowed goal and the second disallowed goal.
Yes. Well, let's move straight on to that one, actually, because again, okay, if we're talking about the sort of technicalities of VAR, Now, the on-pitch decision for that was goal. There was no flag from the linesman. There was no indication from the referee. Of course, VAR
protest every goal. From Tottenham.
Say again?
Or any protest from Tottenham?
Well, I think there was one stuck his hand up, but then I think they do that for absolutely everything and anyway. You know, Spurs player can boot the ball out of touch and they'll still claim the throw-in.
But no Spurs players even appealed for Mitoma's disallowed goal. If you watch the replay, none of them are saying, they're all just thinking, damn it, we've conceded. Yes. Not a single Spurs player has got his hands up going, that's handball. And you know what footballers are like. They will appeal for a throw-in if it comes off their own knee in the most obvious fashion. So for no Spurs player to appeal against Mitoma in that situation tells you a lot. I think one player appeals against Welbeck's goal, but the rest of them aren't that bothered. Obviously, Kane comes running down from centre-forward position to tell the referee how to play it, but, you know, the rest of them didn't. And how can you say clear and obvious error if the on-field decision with that one
is goal?
And then someone has then gone, well, there is a clear and obvious error to disallow it. And we're okay to overrule that one for a clear and obvious error, but not for the previous one. I don't understand how you can decide one is and one isn't.
Yeah, go on. So, but at the time, I'll see that this time the Albion are kicking towards you guys. Mm. Anyone, I mean, did you spot the deflection? Because, I mean, from my point of view, Loris made a pig's ear of it and then you realise it was deflected.
Yeah, I knew it deflected, but I didn't know who it had come off. It could have come off a Spurs player for all I could have seen. I knew it had bounced off someone, but didn't realise who. And Welbeck clearly claimed that goal because he's the one that ran off celebrating and he's the one that we're all cheering and saluting because as far as we were concerned, it was his goal.
So, obviously, when you're in the stadium, the thing comes up, checking possible handball. Mm. Was that the thing that came up on the scoreboard?
No, initially, you know, it was a good goal. The Albion were on their way. Well, they were doing a bit of gameplay, taking their time, doing the celebration. Tottenham were lining up already, you know, effectively waiting for kickoff, yeah. Waiting for our lot to get back. We didn't realise there was a single problem until the referee started, you know.
Well, therein lies the point. As much as Stuart Atwell gets pelters, this one was purely down to VAR, wasn't it?
I would differ slightly on that protest thing because certainly one of the Spurs one of the centre halves, I'll probably say it was Romero, puts his hand up and says he's waving, he's looking at the ref going handball. And then obviously Kane does come running down the pitch. Now, I don't believe for 1 second that Kane saw it. He's just seeing one of his teammates and he's just getting involved as Kane does.
And the weird thing is that when you then see it, I mean, back to Match of the Day, because they're the ones that are showing it sort of widest. It's not even necessarily the case that it's hit his arm anyway.
I don't see how anyone can look at that replay they showed on Match of the Day and say that is clearly and obviously a handball. I can't understand how you can say that. You know, football is meant to be about scoring goals, right? And surely, you know, we say with a lot of things, you know, I think even with attackers, you know, the VAR interpretation of offside sort of bugs me a bit because you've seen some amazing goals. And I'll include some amazing goals against us ruled out. And at the time, it's quite funny. But is that in the interest of football to rule out amazing goals because of some, you know, a bootlace worth of offside? Because yeah. And half the time with that, it only comes down to where you are in your stride. Because, you know, your human body, physically, it goes backwards and forwards as you're running. And your feet yes. might be behind because your torso happens to be a couple of inches further forward and the other bloke's torso is going back. He gets ruled out. And that's surely against the spirit of the game. And to rule that...
John, do you want to have a go at describing what the offside law is supposed to be or we're going to be here too long?
God, don't drop that one on.
let's go with the penalties as well, mate.
Yeah. Okay. Look, I tell you what. What a joy it was yesterday to watch Wrexham Notts County on the telly without any VAR, because there was no breakup in the play whatsoever. You're watching this ding-dong game going end-to-end for 90 minutes, crowd jumping up and down, ball at the back of the net, goal. That's that.
Well, I was actually going to mention this game at the end of the show, but seeing as we're here, you know, we had obviously Jason Stockwood on, the Grimsby Town chairman, 2 or 3 weeks ago when they played us in the cup. And, you know, you can see that there is a renaissance of Grimsby Town coming up and I wish them well. But he did sort of like roll his eyes to the ceiling about sort of, well, you know, Wrexham's hardly a fairy tale because, well, let's face it, they've got twice the the facilities of everyone else now. And even then, they've got the terrace behind the, you know, the stand behind the goal being rebuilt. Are you saying at this point then, John, that there's a side of you who thinks, I wouldn't mind going back to the romance of the National League?
I wouldn't mind going back to the romance of football where the ball hits the back of the net and you can actually celebrate rather than have to wait for 3 minutes, nip out, get a cup of tea, take a pee, come back. Is it a goal yet?
Yeah.
You know, it's that, and they're still hovering about wondering what the hell to do next. You know, it absolutely is killing it for me.
I mean, maybe let's put it this way. I mean, if we're talking about, you know, silly stuff, perhaps next time we score a goal, especially at the Amex, we score a goal and we just stay silent. It won't happen. It can't happen. We stay silent. Then when the other team kicks off, then we go bananas.
I'd love that. I think we should do that.
I think it's something we can do, but it's not going to work, is it, Vicky?
I think the celebration of a goal is a fairly base human reaction, isn't it? I don't think, unless you're sort of 7-0 down when you score your consolation, I don't think that's something you can necessarily do, especially not if it especially if you planned that and it happened to be a really tight, tense game and the winner goes in the 98th minute, then yeah, I don't think you'll get many people sitting on their hands.
Not as such, no. Okay, penalties in a minute, but you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and on podcast. And this show is brought to you in association, as it has been since 2010, with the Shelley Brothers OldFootballShirts.com. They provided us with a shirt of the week. Vicky, now you've told me this one's far too easy, so in that case, John, do you want to describe this and maybe have a work out who it might be?
So what we've got here is green and yellow halves, like, where do we go? Feyenoord type approach. Yellow and green, very distinctive badge on it. That I really don't recognise. Marston's Ales. So we have a clue that we are somewhere around the Burton area. So I think
the badge has been photoshopped quite horribly, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. I mean, quite rightly so, because you'd be able to read it otherwise. But yeah, it's rather natty little, apart from some awful pinstripes, a rather natty little yellow and green number done à la Feyenoord.
So are you going to have a guess? So you reckon it's someone around Staffordshire, Derbyshire area? Or
around Staffordshire.
No. Vicky, do you want to put him out of his misery?
Come on.
Well, hang on. I hope I'm right anyway, but I believe that's a Wrexham shirt. From some time just after the Mickey Thomas era, probably.
And it's a badge, couldn't it?
Yeah. Your shirt of the week, chosen probably, this is Phil, probably that it's a ghastly colour. This is the 1989-90 away shirt of the Football League wannabes AFC Wrexham. Nicknamed the Red Dragons, their home is the Racecourse Ground, which has a capacity of 10,771. I'm really not sure about that, because I say half of it's been knocked down now, being rebuilt. The team was formed in 1864. They are the oldest club in Wales and the third oldest professional football club in the world. They initially played in the combination, which included teams from Northwest England and North Wales. In 1905, they joined the Birmingham District League, where they stayed until 1921, when the Football League Division 3 North was formed, with Wrexham being one of the founder members. As such, they have always played in the English League system, although they have won the Welsh Cup a record 23 times, most recently in 1995, and the FAW Premier Cup, which they've won 5 times, also a record. After the creations of Divisions 3 and 4 in 1958, Wrexham jumped between the two on several occasions. Sadly, in 2004, after another relegation, the side went into administration and the club went into significant decline, which included dropping out of the league in 2008. In November 2020, actors Ryan Reynolds and Robert McElhenney bought the club with almost unanimous approval from the Wrexham Supporters Trust. They who pulled AD up on one of his most famous questions on the Albion Roar. If you want to know how that is, then just ask on Twitter. With the subsequent investment, it would appear that AFC Wrexham will rejoin the Football League for the 23-24 season. Notable former players include Chris Armstrong, who made 60 appearances for Wrexham in the 90s. He went on to Millwall, Palace, and then to Spurs for 7 years before eventually returning to Wrexham to finish his career in 2003. Ian Rush joined the side in 1998. After his time at Newcastle, he played for one season and failed to score. Probably the most famous player ever to wear the red shirt was George Best, who made a testimonial appearance in 1979 for former Wrexham captain Gareth Davis. There are a few links to the Albion, but I've tried to pick out three that wouldn't necessarily be top of everyone's lists. Well, this one is, because Vicky's already mentioned him. How about Mickey Thomas? He played 230 times for Wrexham before moving to Manchester United in 1978. And in 1981, he made the move to the Goldstone Ground and played for just the one season for Brighton, where I believe after he left, he famously gave back his signing on fee because he was that bad. Chris Holroyd was Wrexham's top scorer in 2017-18, and he was with us 2010-11, where he wasn't our top scorer. Dean Saunders made 72 league appearances for the Seagulls, scoring 21 goals between 85 and 87. He began his managerial career in 2008 with Wrexham, where he was in charge for three seasons. And Vicky, don't tell us your favourite Dean Saunders moment, please.
I'm far too young to remember that.
Of course you are. Of course you are. Right. Spurs, back there. The one thing that I think is uniting the vast majority of football, including Spurs fans, who most of whom, or not most, many of whom have been magnanimous enough to say, no idea what's going on here. Anyone want to have a go which universe Atwell and Salisbury are in?
I mean, I can't understand how you can get, you know, six errors in a single game.
Yes.
I don't understand.
Major errors.
It doesn't make any logic whatsoever.
Especially when they are all in favour of one side. Yeah. And that's the thing, isn't it? I did see some Spurs fans arguing that their argument as to why this wasn't a travesty was, well, Lewis Dunk stamped on someone's toe. I've seen the reply. I do accept that Lewis Dunk did tread on someone's toe whilst they were all jostling around before a free kick. I don't think it would count as a stamp, and I'm not sure it warranted the reaction of the Spurs player either. So I'm not sure that quite levels out the three penalty claims and two disallowed goals and potential red card for shoving over Solly March when he was through on goal, which hasn't even been looked at. You know, did the VAR even bother looking at that? Probably not, because they don't seem to bother looking at fouls, do they? Just normal fouls. How do you have that bad a day at the office? I don't understand it.
And I know that Paul Barber's been very quiet this week, so I'd love to be a fly on the wall between him and Howard Webb. That cartoon today just made my day.
We're talking the David Squires cartoon in the Guardian.
David Squires in the Guardian. That was just absolutely hysterical.
People have actually suggested, haven't we? We maybe buy Howard Webb a flat in Lancing, you know, give him his own parking place at the ground. Yeah.
It's something we could do. We could start sending him links to property management companies.
That would be funny.
All of his time down here at the moment, you know.
Despite all of it, I really don't want us to be that club that whinges about refs all the time, because, you know what, everyone could have a bad week. It's just really frustrating. When we had the Palace game, when we go back to that offside goal, it wasn't offside, the non-offside goal, but was disallowed because the VAR drew the lines on the wrong player. I mean, aside from that being staggering, you know, a lot of people whinged about that and said, well, it cost us the game. And my take on that one was actually, do you know what? We had 89 other minutes in that game and plenty more, no doubt, to actually do something else about it. And we missed so many chances in that game. Solly March missed a sitter aside from scoring a good goal. You know, you can't whinge all the time about refereeing decisions. That Palace game, the reason we didn't win it wasn't due to the VAR or the linesman or the ref. It was due to our own crap finishing. Whereas, you know, and other games as well. Yeah, you've got the decision with the thing with Fabinho against Liverpool when he hacked at Evan Ferguson. You think, well, that's a travesty, but, you know, it doesn't cost it. The Spurs game just feels a bit different because I just keep thinking, We couldn't have done anything else. Everything we did, they just cut it down.
Well, scored enough goals to have won.
That's what's frustrating. That, you know, actually, I tend to say, you know, you never lose a game on a refereeing decision. And I still don't think we've lost that game on a refereeing decision. We've lost that game on multiple refereeing decisions.
I just gave up 70 with 75 minutes gone. I thought there's something going on here, but don't get enthusiastic because we're not going to come out of this with a win, and you know what's going to happen. They're going to go up there in the last few minutes and score.
Yeah, I mean, this is the point. I mean, when it got to
I
70
mean.
minutes, it was 70 minutes was the Mitoma one. 79 minutes was Harry Kane's goal, which, yeah, you could argue we should have defended a bit better. We
Yes.
but having said that, if you then, we clearly did enough. We scored three legitimate goals. We should have had two penalties, maybe more. And I'd have
It should have
happily
been
taken a
5-2.
5-2 win at Spurs.
Yeah, it should have been 5-2.
I mean, the shirt pull on Lewis Dunk, we saw that from where we were at the time. And that, from our position, that was the most obvious one because we've actually, we could see it. It was right in front of it. It wasn't just a little quick touch, it was a massive shirt pull. You can see on the replay, he's even doing it with both hands just to make sure. And Dunk is going towards the ball, or he's trying to go towards where the ball went. And instead, the ball lands on Harry Kane's head. And it's clear. And you think, again, the referee is right in front of that. How do you not see that?
Yes.
Or even say, can you upstairs, can you just have a quick look at that? Because I think there might have been a shirt pull. How on earth, or upstairs should be going, Stewie, I think you've just missed a massive shirt pull there. How do you not see that? And that was when we saw that from where we were, and we just thought, this is ridiculous. This
Did
is
you
utterly ridiculous.
think the same about the Mitoma penalty shout as well at the time, or weren't you sure?
The Mitoma one, I thought, oh, I think he's been clipped there, but it wasn't screaming out at me in the same way at first glance, which is why I guess the referee potentially you could forgive him for having that same opinion. Has he actually caught him there? Because he's not brought him down as such. He's trodden on his foot, hasn't he? Which
Yeah.
means he can't pick his foot up to run, and that's why he goes over. But he's not hacked him down. So
Yeah.
you can sort of see why the ref thought maybe that was just Mitoma falling over and trying to win a penalty. But certainly the VAR should be looking at that and going, why isn't that, why hasn't it, is there anything for me there? And he hasn't. And you just think, what's the point? What is the point?
So at the time that you by the time you left the game, 97 minutes, referee blows the final whistle. Do you think that you were actually kind of aware of the full extent of just how bad it was? Or, I mean, did you need the TV to just confirm it, or did you know at the time?
I knew at
I
the time.
do, John, but we were fuming. I mean, there was enough that we had seen to think this is ludicrous. It's completely pointless. I walked away from the game feeling, well, it was a strange combination. On the one hand, I'm fuming. On the other hand, I'm just completely deflated because I think, how on earth could we have done any more? Do you know what? It wasn't even our best performance of the season. We could have played better, and yet we still completely outplayed Spurs. But it just felt like it doesn't matter what we do today. It doesn't matter how well we play, how many chances we create. Lloris made a couple of good saves in the first half. Doesn't matter what we do because the hand of fate is clearly interfering here, and we could play all night and they're just going to keep getting in the way of it.
So were you
And
just waiting for
I wonder
come
if
on,
that
John?
some of that filtered through to the players. I wonder if they were on the point of, what's the point here?
I mean, this is an interesting point that you raised that I've actually seen of all people, Simon Jordan raise. Now, again, virtually nearly all of football is united in certainly in the two penalty appeals. I think they're trying to be diplomatic with regard to the two disallowed goals, although, we know that we're looking at it through Albion tinted glasses, but there's no way you can actually sort of argue against the legitimacy of the penalty claims. But the thing from therein is there was an interesting conversation between Jim White and Simon Jordan and Stuart Pearce. I mean, Stuart Pearce was asked, "Is this the end of the Albion's European hopes?" And he said, "Absolutely not. They're one of the best sides in the country. They're not going to give up on the back of this." And I think it was something that Simon Jordan said that I think really struck a chord, is that Brighton is too well run. They are too professional to feel sorry for themselves over this. And this is where it comes into your point here, John, that probably after the last with the last 10 minutes, you think, what's the point? But they I think are professionals themselves. Now we as fans are still fuming, and there's people are going to have we've got the I'm lucky enough in as much as we've got this show here where we can have a good offload, and we have social media where we can do this, and realize that, like I say, we've got people on our side. But this is no good taking us as fans going to Stamford Bridge on Saturday with that same sort of defeatist attitude. We have no place to feel sorry for ourselves on account of the fact that it does no one any favours.
We said as that game was going on, we were saying, we're going to get someone sent off here, because the players were clearly finding it difficult with, you know, the perception that all these decisions are going against them. You've got a Spurs team which has a lot of, I think the term is proper noises in that
outhousery.
Outhouses, let's call it. You know, you've got Kane for starters. You've got Romero, a massive outhouse. You've got Højbjerg, you know, who spends the whole game niggling at people and kicking at people and committing fouls and gets away with it. You know, they are a team with some quite, you know, Chelsea used to be that kind of team back in the day of Terry and Diego Costa and all that. But Spurs are definitely that team now. And all of that winding up was going on the whole time. And, you know, for our players to have actually kept their heads and not got, you know, we didn't have loads of yellow cards. We didn't get any red cards. For the players to have kept their head is actually a massive credit to them, because they could easily have lost their rags with some of the, there was a lot of pushing and shoving going on in the game. It would have been really easy for some of them to get sent off. And we were fearing that we'd lose someone important for three games, and it didn't happen. So, you know, fair play to the players for that.
Yeah, definitely.
No, I think that's the point that that's on the back of the point that Simon Jordan was making, is that it's important that we go into the Chelsea game with a reset. And you'd like to think, let's bring in sort of PG Moll at this point, is that they're under the microscope of knowing that actually down here their name is dirt. Mm. And all of football knows that their name is dirt is against us. Are they going to over rectify the issue? But my point to you here, John, is if you were head of PG Moll, what could and should be done going forward?
I don't know what you can do, though, because if this comes down to human error, well, all you can do is say to the bloke on, so say to Michael Salisbury, you know, what do you think of those looking back now? If he thought at the time with all of his heart that he was right to say that's not a penalty, that's a handball and that's a handball, you're not going to just change his mind, are you, just by saying to him, we think you're wrong, Michael. So you're still going to have the same human beings doing it. So I just don't really understand. I don't really see what you can do. All the time you have human involvement.
There's talk about bringing in foreign referees, aren't there, with, quite frankly, better referees.
Well, it's interesting you say this, John. I mean, this is, well, you said Paul Barber was quiet. I think he's, the Athletic has reported him as saying that he has actually gone round talking to.
He's up to something.
Various football clubs, not with suggesting that this should be the case, but don't dismiss it.
Mm.
Now, we've seen the World Cups and what have you, and European Championships. What do you think of the idea of non-English referees coming in and officiating the Premier League? Is it something with merit?
If it improves it, no problem at all.
I'm not sure how you can say it, how you would say which ones, you know, how do you say it, who's going to improve it? And also, are other leagues just going to stand there whilst their best refs disappear off to England? I suppose if they pay them enough, they wouldn't mind. I mean, you've had Jarrett Gillett coming over from Australia, haven't you? You know, if they started to say they'd bring the Spanish bloke over that booked about 200 players in the World Cup semi-final, perhaps not him. Mm. But, you know, I don't know. Is it a perception that they're better elsewhere? Because we don't watch all these games abroad. So when we occasionally see a European game and it goes well, we think, oh, they're all better. You know, I keep saying this stuff, this suggestion that, oh, we should bring in ex-players to be the referees. Most players don't even know the rules when they're on the pitch. And they certainly sit there and learn. You know, could you honestly imagine having Jermaine Genus making these decisions, or Jamie O'Hara, or, you know, Paul Merson? Seriously, who on earth would think having Paul Merson as a referee or a VAR is a good thing? It's ludicrous to say you can't judge the game because you're not an ex-player. And I think that is an insult to the refs.
Yeah.
I don't know what the answer is. You could sort of try bringing some of the best ones in. As I said, you'll probably upset other leagues by nicking their refs. But
what about those refs?
You're nicking their players for long enough.
What about those refs who have retired? Who let's look at the referee roster from say 20 years ago, and these people are only say late 50s now. They've got the experience.
Mm.
They must be older than that now, surely, because most of them are 50 odd when they retire. So they're probably in their 70s now.
I mean, Well, I mean, and you know, I'm not saying go back as far as Roger Milford or even Keith Hackett, but you know, there are some. I mean, Howard Webb is one of those. Is his generation I'm thinking of here. He's supposed to be the one that's tidying up the game, and yet, you know, as much as he was respected as a referee, Stuart Atwell and Michael Salisbury have matches this week, either as referees or as fourth officials or as VAR people. So what's clear is that PG Mould don't think there's an issue.
Salisbury's been taken off, hasn't
No, but he's got a championship game this week.
Oh, yeah, he had that last night, yesterday, didn't he? And
Last night,
he
yes.
awarded only a penalty for a foul that was outside the box. And then the linesman overruled
Some
him.
people never learn.
Well,
So
it was the linesman from Brighton that actually called it and said, no, it's outside the box.
this is something that's going to run and run. So let's see if we can actually look at something a tad more positive. The flying, well, he's not really a flying Dutchman, is he? Joel Veltman's 100th game for the Albion. John, give us your lowdown on what you think of Veltman.
Solid, reliable. He's done an awful lot of work for the club. You can call on him at any time. Brilliant squad player.
Love him. I think he is the nearest equivalent we have to an outhouse. I loved watching him against Zaha. I think he properly knows how to wind people up when he needs to, but he's a bit of a smiling assassin, isn't he? And I think, every now and again he has a game where it just doesn't suit him. But mostly he's incredibly solid. He's an incredibly technical footballer, and he rescues seagulls from chimneys with oven gloves. So for that alone, he's a hero.
What's this story then?
Do you not see he was on his
I'm
social
sh
media?
I'm
You're not
sure it
going
has. Remind us.
story of this. Well, he put on his Instagram one day at some point last year, wasn't it, that he was at home and they'd heard this flapping noise coming from their chimney and couldn't work out what it was. So he's on his wife, presumably his wife is doing the videoing as he's peering up the chimney and realizes that a seagull has got stuck up the chimney. And so good old Joel can't leave it there. And so using a pair of oven gloves, he very heroically sort of hoists himself up the chimney, extracts the seagull, and then frees it majestically on Shoreham Beach. What a hero.
What a guy.
You
What
can't
a
beat
guy.
that, can you?
If anyone hasn't heard that story,
That's it's a conversation stopper, that, isn't it?
it was, I don't know if it's still there, but it was on his Instagram at the time. What an absolute legend. You know, at least it was a seagull and not some kind of worse bird like an eagle.
Yeah, well, there is that.
That would have got messy.
Exactly. I mean, it just seems that he's only been with us for 5 minutes, and yeah, here we are, 100 games in. I mean, I guess that's probably just, let's say, almost, I'll say literally one flew under the radar, but the outhouser you're talking about against Zaha was brilliant. And he's not one, I think, didn't he ever also have a little bit of a barney with Thomas Frank as well?
Probably, yeah.
I mean, all right, let's face it, everyone does, but yes, congratulations, Joel, and here's to the next 100. One thing the Albion have announced this week is that we finally hit the big time and we're going to a US tournament pre-season along with another 5 Premier League sides. John, as someone who's worked in the travel industry, this must be quite an exciting thing for the Albion and for the people of New England, isn't it?
Now, where do we start on this? It's exciting for the fans here because a lot of them may not have been to the cities. I just don't see how you're going to sell Brighton versus Newcastle in New Jersey. If it had been Brighton versus Napoli or Roma or somebody, you know, that would have appealed to the local majority of fans, then they would have filled the stadium. I don't quite know where we're going with this. We're playing Brentford in Atlanta, for God's sake. Yeah, we're playing Brentford in Atlanta, and again, you know, I've been to the city. It's a magnificent city, very much underrated. Loves its baseball. They pack the stadiums out there every night. And you're going to tell me that Brighton versus Brentford is going to pull them away from there and their wonderful blues bars? I don't think so. I
It's
just wish there'd be more imagination.
a bunch of pre-season friendlies for us, though, isn't it? And it's a
It's a
little bit
bunch of
of
pre-season
profile.
friendlies for
And do you
us.
know what? If you think that's bad, you've got Fulham against Brentford in, I can't remember where that game is, but that's going to be even
Why couldn't they have
less
got
of a
some
test.
massive? I know the Premier League is sponsoring it, et cetera, but you know, you could have got the River, Boca, the big teams in Latin America to come up. It would have been magnificent, but it's
Presumably,
Obviously,
there'll be
missing
a lot of golfing
opportunity.
clubs as well, though. There'll be plenty of people who decide to go out there for a little trip. Plenty
Oh,
of
there will, no doubt about it.
UK-based Albion fans. I've been
Yes,
thinking about it.
of course.
But it just I do get what you're saying. I think I can't imagine it's going to massively raise the profile. But when I suppose when you've got Chelsea going, Newcastle to a lesser extent, because I don't imagine they've got a huge profile unless there's a big Saudi community in one of those cities.
Spotted
Yeah,
got Villa going as well.
Chelsea are the sort of
Yeah, Chelsea would be the big
pleasant
number.
club that will have plenty of support over there, I'm sure.
Yeah, Chelsea would be the big number. But if I was over there, I'm sorry, I'd be over watching the Mets.
So you're not going.
I'm not going. No, there's no appeal for me for there at all.
I mean, I can understand the point of the Albion going to New England because, certainly since we got promoted to the Premier League, there has been a bit of a groundswell. Probably not quite as much as the mad Japanese since Mitoma signed, but there has been a bit of a groundswell of people, especially in northeast of the States, following the Albion. Now, why they've chosen the Albion, not sure. It's not obvious. I suppose someone has to pick someone. And given how we're playing this season, our profile is rising. So, yes, we can imagine that there's going to be a good couple of hundred we know that are going to be there, but above and beyond that,
But it might also be that because bigger clubs are going to have prior commitments to appease sponsors. So, some of them went to, I think Liverpool went to Australia last year, didn't they? Man United, they may be in Singapore, they may be in, in Beijing or somewhere because they have very high profile overseas sponsors that they have to satisfy by making these trips. So it may well be, well, who can we get out there? Probably Chelsea because Mr. Toad is American, isn't he? And
Yeah,
he
good
must
point.
have connections out there. I can't remember which team he owns, but it's what is it the Dodgers? So I
Oh,
can't remember which
I
one.
don't
It's
know.
awesome.
I don't
Someone
know.
in California, isn't it? Yeah, but I mean, so obviously that's not really his neck of the woods, but
No.
I suppose that's they're the one with the profile. Newcastle will turn up at the opening of an envelope at the moment because they're trying to increase their profile. And their money, obviously, and then for the rest of them, it's like, right, who else is free? Probably, let's be honest, isn't it? Because no one in America is going,
Now,
let
if they had gone to Japan
especially
with
not
Mitoma
Brentford.
in the team, well,
Yeah,
gosh, 70,000 sellout overnight.
I would have
It
preferred.
was
I mean, personally, I'd have
bonkers.
been all over a pre-season tour of Japan. That would have been immense,
Yes.
and I'd have been on the first flight out there.
That would have been
As it is,
absolutely
I might be
brilliant.
on the second flight to Philadelphia, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
And on that note, we have run out of time. I want to say thank you to Vicky Rees, to John Palfrey. Next time we'll have you on, we'll have you under happier circumstances where we're talking about a win where maybe we had a chance of winning. But until then, thank you very much indeed for listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on smart speaker, and on podcast. Show has been brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com. My name's Alan Wares, and we'll see you again next time. Thanks for listening. Bye. I was just
I would run.